Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A federal judge is likely to issue a ruling next week on a request from several states to block President Trump's decision to end cost-sharing payments to health insurance companies. The move is the latest by Trump that many see as an attempt to deliberately harm the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Joining us now is one of the architects of the ACA, Kathleen Sebelius. She was Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Obama. Secretary Sebelius, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
And let's start with these cost-sharing reduction payments that President Trump ended last week through executive order. He says they're just lining the pockets of the insurance companies. And he's been making that case as Congress decides what to do. Is that true, that they are just lining the pockets of the insurance companies?
Well, it's unfortunate that the president doesn't seem to understand the law. And the way the law works, and this is where the cost-sharing subsidies come in, is I, as a customer, choose an insurance company. I give my income as part of the enrollment process. I qualify then for a tax premium to help pay the premiums on a monthly basis. But I also qualify for the cost-sharing subsidy. The insurance company upfront sells me a product that has lower deductibles and lower copays, and they get paid back at the end of every year for that portion of the population. So this is hardly lining their pockets. They are required by law to sell lower income individuals a limited deductible and copay policy, and then they are reimbursed depending on how many of their customers fall into that category.
So what will happen to healthcare markets if these payments are not reinstated? Because it does sound, from what we're hearing, that it's very unclear whether Congress is going to reinstate these payments.
You bet. It is unclear. Well, what we're seeing, Jeremy, all over the country, is that insurance companies who have been paid back a month at a time since the Trump administration came into office in January, they have said consistently, we're not sure we're going to pay these, and they will only pay them a month at a time. So basically, every company that decided to sell products for the 2018 open enrollment, which starts November 1st, right around the corner, raised their 2018 rates, saying, if we don't get paid back, that is an enormous hit to the bottom line. So we have to raise our rates, anticipating that President Trump would do just what he has done. So what we're seeing around the country is rates that are skyrocketing based on Trump care, the new uncertain market. When Congress failed to pass a repeal and replace legislation, the administration has been engaged in very active sabotage to make the markets as unstable and unsteady and expensive as possible.
Well, we called you an architect of the Affordable Care Act. Did you and others design it so that it would be too easy for future presidents to take apart, as you say President Trump is doing?
Well, legislation is always susceptible to changes and amendments from future Congress. What I think has been so surprising about this legislation is that it has been a battle the entire time that President Obama was in office. And now that we see a different administration, the battle has in many ways just escalated. So consumers who are subsidized, who qualify for either premium assistance or for cost-sharing subsidies, in many cases, those consumers will be held harmless because their subsidies are elastic. The ones who will really be hurt in this market are people who make too much money to qualify for the income assistance, and they are going to be seeing 20, 30, 40% rate increases across the country through a very intentional act of this administration.
Do you think that this administration can destroy Obamacare in this way? given the fact that Congress has been unable to repeal and replace it as they'd talked about. But do you think that President Trump can kill Obamacare?
Well, I think they can do a lot of harm to these still relatively fragile, relatively new marketplaces. I find it very encouraging, though, to see that the conversation, Jeremy, has really changed in across America. While this particular, the details of this particular law may be shaky and might have to be revisited, I think we have had a watershed moment on the overall attitudes of Americans about health insurance. People want their prices to go down. They want companies to provide better service. They want to make sure that drug prices come down. What I find to be really interesting is none of the Republican legislation even included a mention of drug pricing, even though the president continues to talk about it. It doesn't appear anywhere in the legislation. So I do think that they can do great harm to this particular structure. I'm not sure they can erase the fundamental changes that have happened in the last 8 years in this country.
That's Kathleen Sebelius, who was Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Obama. She's now CEO of Sebelius Resources, LLC. Secretary Sebelius, thank you.
Great to visit with you, Jeremy.
Well, obscured this week by the controversy over presidential condolences is the question that Senator John McCain and Defense Secretary James Mattis are asking. What happened in Niger on October 4th when four American Green Berets were killed? The Pentagon is investigating. McCain wants Congress to do the same. The soldiers had reportedly been to the area many times, considered it safe. Intel indicated they'd encounter no problem. They were leaving a meeting with local leaders in unarmored pickup trucks when they were ambushed by about 50 fighters said to be ISIS in the sub-Sahara. French planes flew low to scatter the fighters but did not bomb them. A private contractor eventually came to get the bodies but left one behind. Yesterday, Senator McCain said the Trump administration isn't being forthcoming. Language which is drawing comparisons to the Benghazi outcry after Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed in Libya in 2012. Greg Myrie is NPR's national security correspondent. He joins us now. Greg, these troops have been there for a while. What is their mission?
Right. They date back to 2013, or this mission does, and that's when the region really started to get very chaotic and a lot of insurgencies began. And in neighboring Mali and in neighboring Nigeria, we saw the rise of radical Islamist groups, and that's when President Obama began this mission. And it was really a sort of to work with the Army of Niger to make sure you didn't get spillover. The country does have its own security issues, but you were really trying to look at these neighboring countries and made sure it didn't expand into Niger.
Yeah, we should mention the troops who were killed. Staff Sergeant Brian Black, Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Johnson, Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, Staff Sergeant Dustin Wright, all part of the 3rd Special Forces Group out of North Carolina's Fort Bragg. You know, flesh out some of the questions about what happened to them.
Well, we still have a lot of unknowns because the military isn't talking about it. But as you mentioned, these guys were not there on a combat operation, or more broadly, this is not a combat mission. It's to assist and advise the troops of Niger. So we don't know exactly why they got caught unaware by apparently a group of 50 or so insurgents. Three were reported killed right away. And Sergeant Johnson, who you mentioned, his body was he got separated, was killed, and his body was not recovered until 2 days later.
Do we know why?
Oh, we don't. We just know that he was apparently separated. There was a chaotic rescue recovery operation there. The French military, which is also very active in the region, had to be called in using fighter jets to help drive off the attackers and then helicopters to take away the wounded. So we're still trying to piece together a lot of these details, and the military is not telling us very much. And Sergeant Johnson has been the subject of this condolence call to his widow with President Trump in the past couple days.
Right. Her mother confirmed what a congresswoman said, that when the president called, he said, well, he knew what he was getting into, which some saw as insensitive. Others, as we heard in this program, interpreted it as meaning, that these people do risk their lives for us every day. But putting that aside, you mentioned the French planes. We're hearing reports that the French planes could come but weren't allowed to bomb the fighters because of an agreement with Niger. I mean, this is, you know, as you say, there's a lot of fog of conflict here. But is it true that there was a private contractor that ultimately came to get the men?
Well, this is one of the reports we're hearing as well. An American private contractor was involved. So, yes, there are reports. Again, we've been asking the Pentagon and AFRICOM, which is the body responsible for U.S. military missions in Africa, and we haven't got an on-the-record answer from anybody yet.
Yeah. So what's going to happen now in the few seconds we have?
Well, I think there's going to be a reevaluation of the dangers of this mission. Again, it's to advise and assist, not to be a combat operation. So I think they're going to look at it very closely. How were they caught unaware like this? What is the level of danger there? And then I think they'll go from there.
Yeah. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Again, 4 U.S. Green Berets killed in Niger. Greg, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The Netflix hit Stranger Things is back next week for its second season. The show is set in 1980s Hawkins, Indiana. The first season focused on the disappearance of a young boy named Will and his friends' attempts to find him. The story involves the paranormal as well as government conspiracies. Stranger Things was created by Ross and Matt Duffer. Sean Levy is the executive producer, and he joins us now from Culver City, California. Sean Levy, welcome to Here and Now.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
And when the Duffer brothers pitched this show to you, did you think that it would get as big as it did?
Well, first of all, no. And second of all, this was the kind of show that I think never would have sold or been super compelling as a pitch. And so, in fact, the first thing that came my way was a script that the brothers had written on their own for free. And I came across this script through one of the people who worked for me. And as soon as I read it, I knew that this was the arrival of an incredibly vital and specific new voice.
Why?
And it was a page turner, like all of us who watch Stranger Things. I couldn't wait to find out what happened next. And it was just the opening episode, which they had written, because they weren't happy with the momentum that their movie career had at that point. So they decided to just knuckle down, go home, and write the kind of show that they wished existed. And it was suspenseful, it was eerie, but it was ultimately, and I think most critically, it was so anchored in characters that you cared about. And that, I think, remains the heartbeat of our series.
Well, let's listen to a clip from the premiere episode. 4 boys, Will, Mike, Lucas, and Dustin, are playing the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons.
Will, your action!
I don't know!
Fireball!
They have to roll a 13 or higher.
Too risky, cast protection.
The Demogorgon is tired of your silly human bickering. It stops towards you. Boom! Fireball hit Will.
Oh, the Demogorgon coming back into our lives. The kids in this show, though, are so natural. How did you find them?
By auditioning over 1,000 other kids.
Wow.
It was an exhaustive process, and we literally saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids from all over the U.S., but also all over the world, and in fact found some of our kids and teens in other countries. And it was a very long process because we were looking for something more than talent. We were looking for authenticity. And that's why those performances and those characters feel so authentic and so natural, is because these kids are not just good actors. They're comfortable not acting. They're comfortable being on camera and relating to each other with the natural chemistry that exists between them in real life. And I think that's what's so winning about their dynamic.
And there's a big nostalgia factor here. I mean, I was born in the 80s and raised in the 80s, and this brings me back. It's not just the kids, but the way that they're dressed, their hairstyles, the way that, you know, the rooms look in some of the locations in this show.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because for me, you know, I was a kid and a teen in the 80s. And so for me, the show is a profound and super enjoyable nostalgia trip for the Duffer brothers, who were born in like 1984. I've often said to them, this isn't even nostalgia for you. And they point out that it's nostalgia for the movies of the 80s that they watched on VHS in the 90s. And so the way the different people relate to the setting is very different. In fact, my teen daughters, for instance, they love the show, and yet that period has no resonance for them. But I think that for all of us, there's an innocence to that time that we all, whether we lived in those times or not, we all yearn for.
And that innocence perfectly portrayed by Barb on the show. I have to ask you about Barb, who is a studious, nerdy girl played by Shannon Purser. We have a scene of her here with her friend Nancy. She's played by Natalia Dyer. Nancy's just started seeing Steve, who's a popular boy at school. Let's listen.
Nance, seriously, you're going to be so cool now. It's ridiculous.
No, I'm not.
You better still hang out with me. That's all I'm saying. If you become friends with Tommy H. or Carol, I swear.
Gross.
Now, when Barb was killed off, there was a huge outcry. She became an internet meme with hashtags like Justice for Barb, and she was nominated for an Emmy. Why do you think that that character hit such a nerve?
Well, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this because I had the dubious honor of having been the one who killed off Barb because I directed that episode.
So it's your fault, right.
Where the Demogorgon gets her in the upside-down swimming pool. So it is partly my fault. And I think that it became this phenom-level icon because, A, we never see people like Barb on TV. We're used to our characters on television and on screen being kind of somehow idealized versions of regular humans. And Barb looks and feels and talks like many of the people that we are and that we know. And I also think there's something about Barb that doesn't quite fit in a natural, popular way. And I think all of us carry a little bit of that outsider feeling. We're all kind of Barbs trying to pretend to be Steves. But at the end of the day, I think there's something really relatable about feeling a little bit like you don't quite fit in anywhere effortlessly. And ultimately, the show, certainly Barb is the best example of this. It's a championing of the different. It's a championing of those slight outsiders who are loyal to each other and are able to achieve these small victories as a result of that.
Is it possible that Barb is going to come back in season two?
Man, sadly, no. I can confirm that she won't. However, I can also confirm that her legacy is very much present in the plot lines of season two. And there is indeed a quest for the hashtag that you alluded to. There is indeed some form of justice for Barb.
Okay. Well, we will be watching to see what that is. Now, how much pressure is there on you to be a hit at Netflix, which now has a number of big shows, House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, The Crown. But you're one of them, too, at this point.
Yeah, I will say there's almost no pressure to be a hit because they don't have ratings. They're not slave to that numbers game the way conventional networks are and the way movie studios are with theatrical films, where you live and die by your number the next day. And I've walked that road a lot in my career as a film director, and it can give you some very high highs, but it can also make you pander to certain lower common denominators in the quest for a big opening or a big rating number. Netflix wants you to make what you promise them your show will be. And I will say that there's almost no pressure to be a hit.
Well, you've been hugely successful on the big screen as well. I was looking at something that said that the total of your movies has made $2.4 billion so far. Do you, at this point, prefer doing something like what you're doing with Stranger Things on TV to doing the big screen?
It's a really good question because certainly the hierarchy of, oh, well, movies are, you know, big time and TV, well, it's just TV, that mentality from, you know, decades ago, that's long gone. There's real parity in the quality that you can find in both forms. And I do have to say, I still love making movies. And there is an experience in a darkened theater and a big screen that is uniquely gratifying. But to get to make a show like Stranger Things and to see it resonate globally the way that it has, it's irrelevant whether it's on a smaller screen or a big one. The fact that it's been able to penetrate the culture, that's at the end of the day what all of us producers and directors want. We want these stories that we work really hard on telling to find their way into the minds and hearts of audiences such that they leave some kind of footprint in the culture. And by that metric, Stranger Things has been as gratifying a creative experience as I've ever had in my career.
I have to ask you a question because you are there in Hollywood, and all the talk in Hollywood now is about all of the sexual harassment and sexual assault allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And I understand if you don't want to answer this, but I want to give you an opportunity if you do. Were you surprised by that news? And do you think the culture is changing?
I was surprised. Certainly, I see, you know, examples of really troubling low-grade sexism and kind of unequal treatment and gender biases. But the depth and breadth of this disgusting behavior has been really surprising to me. And whether I think that is changing, I think it's too early to tell, but I sure feel like the candor that has been created over these past several weeks is a good thing. And my hope is that both in Hollywood and everywhere else, that these kind of truly dirty secrets that are kept to protect people who don't deserve protection are no longer kept quiet, and that we will see a shift. As you know, I have four daughters, and I'd like to believe that they're going to live and work in a culture that is just completely intolerant of such behavior. And, you know, this is a very, very ugly moment. And my hope is that it does kind of galvanize a new intolerance for behavior like this in our country and in our culture.
Does it feel like an earthquake in the industry right now?
It does indeed. It does indeed every day.
That's Sean Levy, who is the executive producer of the show Stranger Things, which is returning to Netflix on October 27th. Sean Levy, pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And this note, Sean said there's no pressure to be a hit because Netflix doesn't have ratings. Well, Nielsen, the television rating company, announced yesterday that it has found a way to determine which Nielsen homes are streaming Netflix. So ratings may be on the horizon. Hopefully the programming will remain just as good.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The Los Angeles Police Department will soon be the largest in the nation using drones. On Tuesday, an oversight panel in L.A. approved a year-long test of drones to aid in policing. The decision was made despite criticism from activists concerned about privacy or unfair police practices. Ben Johnson covers tech for Here and Now and joins us in the studio. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first, explain to us what technology they will be using in LA. What kind of drones are these and what are they meant to do?
So a couple of things to note here, Jeremy. On the one hand, the LAPD is talking about using just two so-called unmanned aerial systems, aka drones. So this isn't exactly a drone swarm yet, so to speak. What it will likely be is two quadcopter-style drones. They've got legs to land on, maybe some microphones or audio recording equipment, a camera, and four rotating blades. That's why it's called quadcopter. They'll be controlled remotely, likely by a person who's very close to where it's flying, not a more long-range device like what the military uses. What these drones are supposed to do is provide backup to officers on the ground in terms of information gathering, situational awareness, as it's called. Only high-ranking officers will be allowed to approve a specific use of the drones, and the drones will reportedly only be used for really high-risk situations.
And there are people who are against this move. Of course, yes. The LAPD hasn't always had a great reputation in terms of their policies or how officers have behaved in the field. What kind of overreach are LA residents worried about?
Yeah, I think the police department's record of abuse in the eyes of a lot of civilians makes this pretty controversial. There were protests at the hearings of the civilian commission that approved the year-long program this week. Drones are loud. They can be dangerous when they crash. And there's a host of privacy concerns. That's what a lot of people are talking about. Can a police drone fly over your yard? Is that different from when a police helicopter flies over, probably at a much higher altitude? What is done with the recorded data, if there is any? Where is that data stored? Now, interestingly, the LAPD already had two drones that it was given by Seattle police who were eager to get rid of them because of criticism from the public. That was back in 2014. So the question here is what's changed? And I think the answer is drones are more accepted as part of the future. I mean, Amazon's been testing them for delivery. Kids are asking for them for Christmas, obviously very different versions of drones. And a lot of much smaller departments have been testing them as well in certain places, thanks to a relaxation in regulation for law enforcement that was approved by the FAA a little while back.
And we mentioned that LA is the biggest police department that will be using drones. Chicago and New York do not use drones, but it has been used. They have been used in other cities. Do we know how that's been? How's the success?
Yeah, so it's still very early days. This is part of why the program approved is only on the books for a year. It's still a very new technology, Jeremy, in a lot of ways. What has been interesting to see is smaller departments using drones to help them with interesting kind of search and rescue operations. So drones can cover a lot of ground in a short period of time. And this has happened in Wisconsin. Another thing like this happened in Iowa about a year back. And these are very different use cases than in the urban environment. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
You know, this sounds ridiculous, but I wonder if the police drones should have flashing lights and sirens, because these days anybody could fly their drone over your backyard and you want to know if it's the police.
It's very true.
Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now, thank you.
Thank you.
The stories out of Northern California of the wildfires are devastating. We're going to take a closer listen to one now, and a warning, it is breaking our hearts. You heard us say the other day that Kai Logan Shepherd of Redwood Valley, just 14 years old, died as he and his family were fleeing their home in the middle of the night and were caught in the fire. His family, of course, is trying to survive his loss, but also their own injuries. Kai's 17-year-old sister, Cressa, had her legs amputated below the knee. Their mother, Sarah, and father, John, were seriously burned. All have undergone major surgeries and are at different hospitals. Mindy Ramos is keeping vigil. She is Sarah's sister, the children's aunt. She's at the Ronald McDonald House near the Shriners Children's Hospital in Sacramento, trying to keep watch now over her niece, Cressa. And we're so grateful that she's taking a few minutes for us. Mindy, we are so sorry. This has to be stunning for you.
It's completely devastating. It's so multifaceted. It's hard to wrap one's head around.
And remind us, this is a, you know, tight-knit, small community.
Yeah.
You grew up there?
Yeah, I grew up in Redwood Valley along with my sister. My parents have been in the community for about 45 years. It's very small. To give an example, when I was home for just a short day, I went to get coffee with a friend and ran into my kindergarten teacher.
Oh, and so we know this is devastating the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
Kai, your nephew, the principal of Eagle Peak Middle School, where he went to school, eighth grade, says he was, you know, a kid always had a smile on his face.
Yes, he had the best smile. He had these amazing dimples and just one of those smiles that just beamed sunshine. Like you couldn't help return it when you got one of Kai's smiles. It was a special, special moment.
Yeah. His sister, 17, how is she doing?
Cressa Jean is really fighting hard right now. She's definitely had the roughest go as far as her injuries. They're really concerned about her lungs right now. She's undergoing emergency dialysis, and they do have her stable, but it's a horrific process healing from burns. There's ups and downs, and we're just right here with them trying to, you know, muster all of our strength for them.
We know your sister Sarah burns over 60% of her body.
Yeah.
Has she opened her eyes?
Yeah, Sarah opens her eyes a lot, and she has beautiful hazel eyes, so it's wonderful to see. She also turns her head towards our voices, and she has been able to nod yes or no and respond to questions from the nurses, like about her pain level. So she's trying very hard to communicate, we feel. I'm sure she has a lot of questions.
Well, are you going to give her or John, your brother-in-law, the answers? He still has a tube down his throat helping him breathe.
Yeah, right now, we're not, you know, we don't believe they know about Kai. We're not real sure until we can communicate. And so, unfortunately, that's another hell that we're going to have to go through.
Oh, this is just devastating. Look, we want to get beyond that horrible headline. It's not just that this happened, that they somehow were, everyone thinks, coming down the driveway when you all thought that they would not be in harm's way. They were just leaving.
We thought they were leaving in plenty of time. They had been alerted by a neighbor that the fire was coming. I don't think they could see the fire even very clearly from their house. And so they didn't know how quickly it was moving. I mean, they did everything they could to get out of there as quickly as one would in that situation. They would never put their children in harm's way. Mm. And the fire just overtook them. I mean, their driveway is a mile and a half long up a winding mountain road.
Well, the thinking is they tried to escape on foot, that Kai could not get away from the fire. But Sarah and Cressa, your sister and your niece, are we understanding this correctly? This happened in the middle of the night, that they somehow became separated when they fled from the car. This is the thinking. Cressa and Sarah found together around 5 a.m. Mm-hmm. They were able to speak.
Yeah.
Cressa wanted to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
But just, what a horror.
I can't imagine what they endured and the fact that they were lucid when they were found. I mean, what went on for those essentially 4 hours, we may never know exactly. And we still, unfortunately, the coroner's not had time to see Kai yet. So we don't know if it was the flames or if it was the smoke. He was asthmatic. So we have a lot of questions, and unfortunately, there may not be answers for some of them.
The home that they built by hand?
Yes. Oh, gosh, one of their lifelong dreams really was to own some land in Redwood Valley and build their own home. John was a carpenter, is a carpenter. And, I mean, it was a painstaking process, and they poured love into every single thing they did. And it's gone. It's all gone.
Yeah. We know you've started a fundraiser.
Yes. You know, at this point, we can't even wrap our head around what long-term support everyone is going to need. Are they going to want to return to the mountain and rebuild a home? We don't know. There's still so many questions, but we know that we want them to have the best care and the best rehabilitation possible, and that the outpouring of support has been incredible, absolutely incredible.
Well, you ask, you don't know if your sister or husband and daughter want to return to the mountain. I mean, can you tell now if they'll be able to?
That's a really good question. Cressa is going to have a much different life after this. We don't know yet what her mobility will be. We did hear from the doctor today that she will be quite debilitated, and there will be quite a lot of physical therapy to come. I don't know. I think there's question about, I mean, there's still questions for the doctors themselves about how they will be able to use their hands or an eyesight. Those are two things that I know that are being watched in all patients right now, you know. We just don't know. We're grateful they're alive now, and we want that to continue. And, you know, whatever we can do to help improve the quality of their lives from here on out, because it's just all, it's all different.
It is, in a flash.
Yep.
Look, this little town, you know, Redwood Valley, so small, there's not even a population sign,
that's
you
right.
Tell us. 430 homes lost.
Yeah.
Your sister's home, complete ash. The cars melted.
Yes.
You've lost a nephew.
Yeah.
I mean, just your thoughts on, you love, obviously love this town. You grew up there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Your thoughts on how quickly everything can go.
Oh, God. I mean, Gosh, the fire moved so fast. And I mean, we didn't have a chance there, you know? I mean, people had to flee uphill instead of downhill. And it just, I mean, I can't even count the number of people I know personally that lost homes, entire homes. You know, and I hate that it's taken this kind of tragedy, but I really feel, not just in my community, but all over the world, I feel like humans are really stepping up for other humans right now. I mean, people that have lost their entire homes are still giving to our fundraiser, you know, and mm-hmm. I just, that kind of generosity and that kind of support takes my breath away.
Yeah. Well, we're so sorry for the loss of your nephew. Well, by the way, do you have children of your own?
I do. I have a 5-year-old and a 12-year-old who lost a cousin. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody. They've lost a cousin. Your parents have lost a grandchild.
Yeah.
Look, we are so sorry for your loss. And just, we'll keep you in our thoughts.
Thank you so much.
We will link you to the fundraiser that Mindy Ramos started for the Shepherd family at hereandnow.org. We also have family pictures Mindy shared with us. And if you're looking for ways to help all of those impacted by the fires in Northern California, there are several relief funds, including Redwood Credit Union's North Bay Fire Relief Fund, a partnership between the Santa Rosa Press Democrat and California State Senator Mike McGuire. So far, they've raised more than $6 million. This week began giving it away to pay for food and short-term housing and to help kids who've lost homes with school clothes and supplies. Again, hereandnow.org.
And it is Amazon deadline day. Cities that want to win the company's second headquarters have until the stroke of midnight to submit their bids. The prize is 50,000 high-paying jobs, and cities around the country are falling all over themselves to get them. Leaders in Stonecrest, Georgia, say they'll rename their city Amazon if they win. New York is proposing 4 neighborhoods, including Lower Manhattan and Long Island City and Queens. New Hampshire is pitching itself as close to Boston, but with less traffic and no income tax. Detroit says it'll offer access to a talent pool in southern Ontario. And Tucson, Arizona tried to send a 21-foot cactus to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos. He turned it down. Let's hear now from 2 cities that are considered top contenders, starting with Austin, Texas. Here's KUT's Jimmy Moss.
Just about every city wants to win this competition, Austin, of course, included. Mike Berman is a senior vice president at the Austin Chamber of Commerce.
We formally submitted the Austin region bid for Amazon HQ2.
So what does Amazon want in its applicants? The company would like a large city that can provide an educated growing workforce, a strong economy, and space to build a campus. There have been numerous analyses determining lead cities in this hunt, from Moody's Analytics to the New York Times. Many of the usual suspects have topped those lists, from New York to Los Angeles, Denver to, yes, Austin. Coincidentally, both Denver and Austin officially submitted their bids Wednesday. Now that it's done,
they left it vague in terms of saying that it was 2018. So they said they would make an announcement in 2018, but that's as much as they provided.
So Austin waits, along with dozens and dozens of other metropolitan areas. For Here and Now, I'm Jimmy Moss in Austin.
Well, as we heard, Austin would have to be Denver, so let's go there with Ben Marcus from Colorado Public Radio.
There's always been competition in economic development, but this is different.
It's very unusual for these things to happen as publicly as they have happened. Most of the time in economic development, the companies require secrecy and maintain secrecy throughout.
That's J.J. Ament, the guy who's helping to coordinate Colorado's bid for the headquarters, working together with state and local governments. He runs the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation. Cities have not been shy about wanting Amazon, but the details of the bid are confidential. Ament says that the Denver area does have everything that Amazon wants: educated workers, good public transportation, high quality of life. Ever since the New York Times anointed Denver as the frontrunner for Amazon's second headquarters, excitement has been at a fever pitch. This is the kind of economic development deal that guys like Ament tell their grandkids about.
I don't see negatives for Amazon coming here, but I do see it helping us focus everyone's attention on the infrastructure that we need, the infrastructure needs that we have as a community.
Roads, housing, schools are already strained, even without 50,000 additional high-paid workers. But J.J. Ament says slow down. All these jobs would not come at once.
This is not a relocation. This is the introduction of a second headquarters. So it's not going to be a mass movement from one community to another.
Amazon says its second headquarters could take more than a decade to house all 50,000 employees. But once all the employees are in place and they're spending money in the community, going out to restaurants and shopping, they'll likely create another 25,000 jobs. If the headquarters ends up here, Martin Shields, an economist with CSU, says Amazon would eventually be responsible for nearly an entire year's worth of job creation in Colorado.
It's just an unbelievable scale in terms of economic development.
But who will actually fill those jobs is an open question. Colorado has the second lowest unemployment rate in the country, 2.4%. And so companies are already importing a lot of workers.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, anyone that can and wants to work in Colorado has a job right now. And so the way that you capture employees is either have them move in from elsewhere or take them from other businesses.
Amazon is notorious for paying high wages to attract talent. And some local tech companies grumble privately about having to compete with the giant online retailer for workers. Martin Shields, the CSU economist, says Amazon alone could end up lifting the state's average wages, which have been slow to rise following the recession.
There's benefits of more jobs, of higher wages. Those are a bigger tax base, all things that people want. But then there's a cost to that. We bring more people in. We demand more public services. We put upward pressure on housing prices. We potentially gentrify neighborhoods. There's no free lunch in this.
Metro Denver home prices have risen 60% in less than a decade, and builders aren't even close to building enough new homes for the current population growth. Still, Governor John Hickenlooper, the state's chief economic development cheerleader, says closing the borders to big companies is not the answer. 30 years ago, he lost his job as an oil and gas geologist in Denver. The economy and his prospects here were bleak. Many people just left.
If we're going to grow... And again, if you say you don't want to grow, boy, it's hard to restart it. Once your growth stops and you say, well, we're going to take a break for a few years, you don't just turn it on like a faucet.
In that context, economic development leaders say the prospect of landing a second Amazon headquarters here may turn out to be a good problem. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus.
And again, the Amazon HQ2 bids due at midnight tonight. What an exciting story all across the country. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.